Hi, I'm Hans Tenbaum with Valley Forge PC Repair. I offer affordable and expert computer repair services. Deal with a locally owned business who cares more about their clients' needs. The services provided include virus removal, repair, cleanups, tune-ups, tutoring, consulting, and other computer services. Most services can be done at a flat rate. Senior citizens mentioned WFIL receive a 10% discount. Call me at 610-462-3210 for more information.
ShopRite of Hatfield is American-owned, locally operated grocer. We support veterans and seniors by giving 5% discounts. Just bring in your ID. Download the ShopRite mobile app to enjoy weekly savings, coupons, recipes, and so much more. ShopRite of Hatfield, 170 40-foot road, open 7 days a week, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m.
ShopRite, we're all about food, savings, and you.
Welcome to We the People, the Constitution Matters. I am your host, Gary Porter, Executive Director of the Constitution Leadership Initiative. And it is my pleasure to be with you this fine Friday morning to talk about the Constitution. Last week, you may recall, we interviewed Pastor David Whitney, the senior instructor at the Institute on the Constitution. And he told us about the various programs that the Institute has available, the courses it has constructed, the host kits that it makes available for those that want to get involved in this grand project of ours, educating the American people about their Constitution. And today we're going to talk to another one of our regular commentators, Mr. Phil Duffy. Mr. Phil Duffy is an instructor of the Constitution and other topics at the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute. Now, the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute is a very verbose program. It's available in 119 different campuses across the United States and in all 50 states. And this one happens to be located at Widener University, just southwest of Philadelphia, in Chester, Pennsylvania. And that's where Mr. Duffy teaches the courses that he does. So, good morning, Phil. How are you?
Good morning, Gary. Feeling very well. How about you?
A great constitutional morning. So, you are a retired software engineer or software architect. That seems like a very heady occupation. It would be very daunting for most of us to consider taking on an occupation like that. But tell us how you turned that occupation into teaching about the Constitution.
Well, first I need to emphasize that my exposure to the Constitution is as an ordinary citizen. I have no special legal training, and what I've learned about the Constitution has resulted primarily from personal study. And, you know, one might ask, isn't this like medicine where we really ought to rely upon the experts and so forth? And I guess the emphasis I would have here is that this is an entirely different situation. This is the primary protection of the citizen against the inherent tyranny of the governing majority, if you will. And the Constitution itself is not a mysterious document. It very, very few legal terms are used in it, easily looked up, by the way, now that we have the World Wide Web that we can access. It's basically about 26 pages. It's the equivalent of a short story. And we need not get through it, in one sitting. It's probably better to just go through it bit by bit and ponder it. But I think one of incidents in my life that emphasized to me that we should not rely upon the experts is I was listening to NPR one day, and there was a constitutional professor at the University of California in Berkeley, kind of at the top of the legal profession here, if you will, and he had made a comment about habeas corpus, which is really even more fundamental than the five basic freedoms that we have. If we don't have habeas corpus, we can be locked up someplace, and it really doesn't matter whether we have freedom of religion, speech, and all the rest of it. It doesn't do us very much good. So basically, he had made this comment that the Constitution was silent about habeas corpus. And I said, that doesn't make sense to me. And I went through my Constitution, and there it was in Article 1, Section 9 of the Constitution that, Congress could do nothing to dismiss habeas corpus. Now, the positioning in the Constitution was very important because Article 1, Section 9 describes all of those things specifically that Congress may not do. And here was a man who was at the top of the profession and being supported, not questioned, by National Public Radio, that, there was nothing in the Constitution about habeas corpus. Presidents and Congress and anybody else who wanted to may override it. This doesn't make any sense at all. So I think it's very wise for us to question our so-called specialists. I think also we need to understand that the lawyer's training does not necessarily prepare the lawyer for understanding the Constitution. Basically today, and I think this has been the case since the late 19th century, the law schools have emphasized case law and have virtually ignored an in-depth study of the Constitution. And what this means is that lawyers tend to rely very, very heavily upon case precedent and how that is interpreted by various levels in the judiciary system. And to me, that's a mistake. The Constitution is the foundation of our law. Everything begins there. If we're going to talk about precedent, it has the ultimate precedent. You look to the Constitution first to determine whether something is legal or constitutional. And if it's if the Constitution itself is not explicit, and occasionally it isn't, then we look to supporting documents like the Federalist Papers. So I think that convinced me that it certainly was within the realm of possibility for an ordinary citizen to really understand the Constitution. And so, yes.
Speaking of mistakes, I forgot to mention that we do have a call-in program. And any of our listeners can call in at any time to ask a question of you or I. The call-in number is 610-539-TALK. That's 610-539-8255. And if any of our listeners call in during the first 30 minutes of this show this morning, we will send them a free pocket constitution just for taking the time to interact with us. So go on now and let's talk about how you actually got involved with Osher.
Well, I became involved in a study of the Constitution as a result of a successful legal action by the Free Thought Society of Philadelphia. And the Free Thought Society of Philadelphia is the atheist group in this metropolitan area. And basically the case was against the Chester County Commissioners to remove a Ten Commandments plaque from outside of the Chester County Courthouse as a violation of the alleged wall of separation between church and state in our Constitution. So the commissioners appealed successfully, claiming that the plaque did not establish a religion. But my investigation of the Constitution and the Federalist led me to believe that both sides were wrong and that there is no such thing as separation between church and state in the Constitution. Now, that may be a surprise to many people, but there is only a prohibition against Congress establishing or prohibiting a religion. Now, Congress wasn't involved in placing the plaque on the courthouse wall. In fact, the state wasn't even involved in that action. This was a local county action, and the Constitution does not address that. In fact, if anything, the Constitution assumes that if it's not explicit, if it does not grant the federal government a power, that the power does not exist. And so the federal government really should not have had jurisdiction in this matter at all. So that's how I get started.
Oh, that's great. And then so now, besides the Constitution, let's briefly talk about the other courses that you currently teach at Osher.
Well, I'm involved in three courses right now. One of the courses is a basic course in macroeconomics, which sounds like it's a very, very esoteric subject. It really isn't. It's all about how economies work and how individuals within economies work. And the course is called Whatever Happened to Penny Candy. And it basically starts with, you know, what is money and how do we use it? What's its function? And how can we destroy its value? The second course is called Profiles in Healing. And Profiles in Healing is historical anecdotes about the reconciliation between former enemies. We have some marvelous incidents that have come out of World War II, for example. Former enemies, Germany and the United States, and other nations in Europe with Germany. And some of these stories are just remarkable about how people have learned from their mistakes and learned to reconcile with each other over time.
Well, that's neat. So when is the next opportunity for someone to take your Constitution course? When will that come up again?
We don't have a course scheduled, but I would assume that sometime in the spring session of 2016 that I would be teaching the course again.
Okay, and if somebody wanted to take that course or one of your present courses, how do they get involved? How do they connect with Osher?
Well, I think the first thing they want to do is to contact to determine whether or not they are in this area. So in this area, they would contact Osher Lifelong Learning, Widener University, and that would get them to the Exton campus in Chester County. And I should point out that the course itself is not in Chester. Widener University is in Chester, by the way, but this campus is in Exton in Chester County. So they would probably do a search on the internet to come up with the program. The program would lead them to the catalog, and they would see all kinds of courses, a rich range of courses offered by people like myself who provide the instruction.
Is there a cost involved, and what is the age range of your students?
Generally, these are retired students. I don't know that there is an absolute age limit. Typically, they are retired people. The courses are given during the work day, for example, so it would be a conflict for those people who are working during the day.
Okay, and do you know whether there's a cost involved, or are these free courses?
The courses are not free, but they're very, very reasonable. I believe $75 for two courses, and I think it's something like $40 or $45 for a single course. The courses are either 5 or 10 weeks, and altogether the time for a course is about 6 hours. So, you know, if we look at the Constitution course, we're covering the Constitution in approximately 6 hours. It's a six-hour investment, but spread over five days. And I should mention that the course is highly visualized, so that you know, it's hopefully not a boring lecture.
Well, I know what it's like to try to cover the Constitution in that short a period of time. I'm actually down in Tennessee today, visiting friends, and tomorrow I'll be teaching a Constitution seminar in Knoxville, Tennessee. There's still room for people to get involved if they want to. They can send me an email at gary@constitutionleadership.org. But yes, teaching the Constitution in a compact format is a challenge. Now, I was looking at the outline of the course that you sent me, and it was really, really intriguing because you do go into some of the historical background prior to the Constitution, drawing from Aristotle and Plato. Thomas Aquinas, John Locke, and Montesquieu. Tell me about why that is important. Why can't we just pick up the Constitution and start reading it, we the people?
Well, I think we have to understand that the Constitution is something that has evolved out of a whole series of ideas and a series of incidents. Of course, we know in the more, you know, the Declaration of Independence that a period of approximately, I guess, about 11 years or so went by between the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. And basically, the Declaration of Independence was a general statement of principle that was put out before the people who became the people of the United States. And in that intervening period, we went through kind of an emergency, if you will, and a testing period about, well, how are we going to implement these principles? And so we had that kind of cause and effect between the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. But that really is superficial by comparison with an understanding of the growth of thinking in the Western world that occurred that was behind the Constitution. I mean, ultimately, you can go back to Aristotle and Plato for some concepts that evolved. I think one of the most significant of the concepts that evolved came later, after Plato and Aristotle, from Jesus of Nazareth, who looked upon the ordinary individual as having value and merit. And until that philosophy, if you will, evolved, the individual was really just a part of an overall machine called the state as we know it today. So these ideas were extremely important. Montesquieu came up with the idea of separation of powers, which in the Constitution is found not only between or among the three branches of government, but also the concept of the separation of powers or sovereignty between the federal government and the state governments. So these were very, very important concepts. A fellow by the name of Moses Mendelssohn, who was Felix Mendelssohn's grandson, was responsible for this idea of the so-called separation of church and state that is a part of that thinking. Now, that was implemented in a very specific way in our Constitution, in Amendment 1, which says that there is something called freedom of religion, and government should not create or establish nor prohibit a religion.
Right. Well, I was interested to see Moses Mendelssohn's name in that list, and thanks for enlightening us on that. How about John Locke? What is his contribution?
Well, John Locke is most famous for the idea that we have individual freedom, that our greatest possession is our own selves, if you will, the right to life, liberty, and what he called estate, which is property. Now, Jefferson changed that to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And our first inclination is to look at that idea of the change, if you will, away from property to the pursuit of happiness and say, maybe the framers of the Constitution were defensive about the idea of property. I think in retrospect that's not really the case, that I think Jefferson was looking at property and saying, you know, property, the ability to acquire property and to use property is fundamental, but it is a part of something that is even greater, which is our ability to pursue our own happiness, if you will.
Well, yes, and I should add that the idea of property was fundamental in the founding period. just because Jefferson chose to substitute pursuit of happiness for property doesn't mean that even Jefferson was ignoring that idea. And if you look at the Virginia Declaration of Rights, if you look at other declarations of the time, state constitutions, you'll find that all of them recognize property as a fundamental right. The ability to hold, maintain, possess property was a fundamental right. Let me read you the way the Virginia Declaration of Rights states it. Section 1, that all men are by nature equally free and independent and have certain inherent rights. Now, Jefferson called them inalienable rights. George Mason, who penned the Declaration here, calls them inherent rights, of which, when they enter into a state of society, they cannot, by any compact, deprive or divest their posterity, namely, the enjoyment of life and liberty, with the means of acquiring and possessing property, and pursuing and obtaining happiness and safety. Now, this is important because this declaration was penned about a month before Jefferson sat down in Philadelphia and penned the Declaration. And I would venture to say that a copy of George Mason's document was probably in Jefferson's hands when he sat down in Philadelphia to pen the Declaration. So, you know, he understood these concepts, and just because he chose to focus more on this pursuit of happiness aspect instead of property doesn't mean that he was necessarily ignoring it or that any of the founders would have ignored it. Do you agree?
Oh, absolutely. I think that is the appropriate view of the whole thing. And there's something about this pursuit of happiness as a larger concept, I think, that is very significant. I mean, when we think in terms of the people who had left the old world and came to the new world and so forth, they were looking for a new way of life. They were looking to be able to throw off the shackles of the old world and to move out and not be inhibited by government, to have government there in a minimal role for protection against external enemies and internal violence. But other than that, they wanted an opportunity to pursue their own interests. And curiously, those interests were very, very much in concert with the needs of society. There is a concept called the general welfare that is a part of the Constitution. I think pretty much misunderstood today, but nonetheless, that idea was very, very much a part of this so-called individual pursuit of happiness.
Well, that's true. And when we come back from our break here in a few minutes, I would hope we can get into that idea of the general welfare clause and what it has become, what the Supreme Court has turned it into, as opposed to what it originally started out to be. But the founders wanted a government that basically left them free to pursue their own pursuits, as long as they didn't trample on the rights of others. Last week we had David Whitney on, and he summed it up as the American view consisting of this: there is a creator God, our rights come from him, and the purpose of government is to secure those rights so that we can pursue our happiness and safety. That's kind of the American view, the Reader's Digest condensed version. So I want to thank our sponsors for the show, Valley Forge PC Repair and ShopRite, and remind our readers that, our listeners rather, that they can call in to 610-539-TALK or 610-539-8255 and ask Phil Duffy, our instructor at the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute, or myself, Gary Porter, Executive Director of the Constitution Leadership Initiative, any question about the Constitution. And we will be happy to pursue that. As you pursue your happiness, we'll be happy to pursue the Constitution with you. So with that in mind, let's take a short break, and we'll be right back after this. Thank you.
fighting for your liberty right here in Philadelphia. Broadcasting freedom shining light throughout the tri-state area. Streaming freedom shining light from Philly to the nations. 1180 shining forth, we are the Freedom Station. WFYN.
News Radio, I'm Paul Stevens. The U.S. flag set to fly over the U.S. Embassy in Havana, Cuba this morning for the first time in decades, a ceremony featuring Secretary of State John Kerry, all part of a controversial thaw in relations between both countries.
Walking around the Capitol, I've met friendly Cubans who tell me that they're glad the Americans are back and that more should visit and that we should help them end the U.S. embargo.
Fox Radio's Evan Brown in Havana. Some members of Congress, however, saying Cuba needs to improve human rights. Mustard-colored tainted water from the Animas River in Colorado is slowly improving after a toxic spill by an EPA contractor.
The wastewater from the spill contains high levels of arsenic, lead, and other potentially toxic heavy metals. In northern New Mexico, farmers and ranchers in the Navajo Nation are concerned about the pollutants flowing into the San Juan River.
Fox's Jackie Ibanez. Fox News, we report, you decide.
Hey, Grandma, can you help me with my Common Core lesson on the Constitution? But the only part we're reading in eighth grade is the preamble and the First Amendment. I wonder when we'll get to study the rest of it. Didn't you say our founding fathers were wise patriots and wrote the Constitution and the Bill of Rights to protect our freedom? This Common Core book we're reading says our founding fathers were racist and they didn't think women or blacks should ever be allowed to vote. She says, we the people. Didn't really mean you and me, but some rich white guys. That just makes me feel terrible about our country. We need to change things.
Oh, honey, that's not true at all. Our country is the greatest country the world has ever seen, and our founding fathers worked hard to be fair to everyone. I'm going to call our school board and our state board of education and ask why they allow Common Core and this book in your school.
Call your representatives now and ask them to stop Common Core and restore local control. Pennsylvanians Against Common Core brought you this message. Go to nopacommoncore.com or call 484-678-2236.
Hi, I'm Hans Tenbaum with Valley Forge PC Repair. I offer affordable and expert computer repair services. Deal with a locally owned business who cares more about their clients' needs. The services provided include virus removal, repair, cleanups, tune-ups, tutoring, consulting, and other computer services. Most services can be done at a flat rate. Senior citizens mentioned WFIL receive a 10% discount. Call me at 610-462-3210 for more information.
ShopRite of Hatfield is American-owned, locally operated grocer. We support veterans and seniors by giving 5% discounts. Just bring in your ID. Download the ShopRite mobile app to enjoy weekly savings, coupons, recipes, and so much more. ShopRite of Hatfield, 170 40-foot road, open 7 days a week, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m.
ShopRite, we're all about food, savings, and you.
And welcome back. Welcome back to We the People, the Constitution Matters. We are, I am Gary Porter, Executive Director of the Constitution Leadership Initiative, host of the show, and we're talking today with Mr. Phil Duffy, Instructor of the Constitution and other courses at the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute, which is positioned in Widener University's campus near Philadelphia. So, Phil, in the last segment, we started talking about the General Welfare Clause and how that has been misinterpreted or stretched, if you will. Let me begin by reading that. This comes from Article 1, Section 8, and it says, "The Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises, to pay the debts, and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States." And it goes on to say, but all duties, imposts, and excises shall be uniform. So that's what the founders gave us. Congress has this power to lay and collect taxes so that they can provide for the common defense and this thing, this amorphous thing called the general welfare of the United States. Now, what do you think? What's your view of the founders' view of that phrase, general welfare of the United States?
Well, the issue with the general welfare was first raised in the Federalist. And apparently, the critics of the Constitution were claiming that the general welfare idea would be used as a general hunting license, if you will, a wide open hunting license for those people who wanted to expand the powers of the federal government. Those critics, as it's turned out, were correct. However, Madison had addressed that in one of the Federalist essays, I believe it was 39. But in any case, he was very specific about what are we talking about here. And he says it's quite often that we talk about something in general and then give specific examples. He basically said the specific examples are the things that we're really talking about here. The general welfare idea is not a release from those general principles. The general principles are the enumeration of powers. And essentially that is in Article 1, Section 8, where you see the federal powers that have been granted. And the idea is that beyond these powers, the federal government has no jurisdiction. And so he says, this is what it's about. It's not about these federal legislators can get together and have a so-called general welfare moment in which they can do whatever they want to, claiming that it's in the general welfare. No, that's not the way the Constitution operates. And in fact, he uses a specific term. He says the idea that this can be used as a general way to expand the powers of the federal government is an absurdity. So we have to look at the general welfare as being things like defense, which is identified in the first article 1, Section 8, the protection against internal violence, that kind of thing, and a whole series of other things. I think there are about 17 powers that are granted specifically in Article 1, Section 8. But his point was, it doesn't really go beyond that. You can't just invoke the general welfare as kind of like a trump card.
Well, the Supreme Court kind of took that view for a long time, and they took a very narrow view of the general welfare clause until 1930s, and in that era, we had some very dramatic things happen in the court and in the nation. Of course, we were facing a war, World War II, but we also had a president, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who had some grand ideas about how to change, fundamentally transform, if you will, our country in some fundamental ways, and he started running up against a Supreme Court that didn't see his views this way, that didn't agree with him, and he threatened to pack the court with six new members that would probably see things more generally in his direction, and suddenly we see the Supreme Court taking a different view in terms of some of the New Deal legislation. And one of those landmark cases, I'm sure you're very familiar with it, Helfering versus Davis, 1937. And that is the case in which the Supreme Court decided that Social Security was going to be a constitutionally permissible program under the General Welfare Clause. So now Social Security, which benefits specific individuals who reach a certain age and apply to this program, that is now permissible under the general welfare, the understanding of general welfare. So do you have a view of this Helfering versus Davis case, or whether Social Security or similar programs which benefit specific individuals really should be considered as part of the general welfare under the Federalist understanding of general welfare?
Oh, it's an outright violation of the Constitution. And certainly when you bring in Madison's impressions and calls that idea an absurdity, Yes, it's an absolute violation of the spirit of the Constitution and a violation of our basic rights, because ultimately the federal government gets involved in taking and redistributing property, if you will, redistributing wealth in order to support this scheme. And today we have seen how that has evolved. I mean, originally there was this separate insurance fund that could not be tapped by the federal government for any reason. And that has gone by the boards. It's now all in the general fund. There is no protection. And this is where that course in macroeconomics is important, because we get into the area of federal debt. And we're looking today at a so-called publicly stated debt of $18 trillion, an amount that is so large that most people can't even get their minds around it. But basically, if you look at the additional debt that is involved in liabilities as a result of the Social Security program and other entitlement programs, Medicare, Medicaid, and so forth that have come along, we're talking about a debt that many have who are aware of the full economic picture, say is up in the category of $100 trillion.
So how do we fix this? I mean, if we could just magically inform and educate our 325 million inhabitants or citizens of the United States, and tomorrow they would all wake up with a complete and accurate understanding of the general welfare clause as the founders would have seen it, then that's great. That's one step in this process, but that doesn't fix the problem. How do we fix this misunderstanding of the general welfare clause?
Well, if we're talking about specifically the general welfare clause, that one can be fixed very, very easily. I put together some simple wording that basically says the general welfare as specified in this Constitution. That restricts it completely. So the general welfare idea can be resolved very, very simply with a simply stated amendment. And I think that would be a major step forward. I believe that as a result of that, people would start to become curious about their Constitution and about the logic, how the parts of the Constitution fit together. But let's not assume that will correct all of the problems. I mean, there are two other clauses in there that are a severe problem. One is the interstate commerce clause, which is similarly open-ended, and we've seen some absurd interpretations of that, with the courts claiming that if somebody grows a crop on their property and it never is sold over state lines, that the federal government still has jurisdiction over the way that crop will be raised and how much of that crop will be raised and that kind of thing. Well, you know, there are that's a tougher one to tighten up than the general welfare, by the way.
Yeah, so you're referring to Wickard v. Filburn specifically for our listeners.
Well, thank you for that. That wasn't off the top of my head, so I'm glad that you filled in on that one. But there's also another area that could be tightened up very, very nicely by eliminating it. The last so-called power is the necessary and proper clause in Article 1, Section 8.
Right.
And that's redundant. We don't need that, because the role of all legislative bodies is to provide the laws that are necessary and proper according to the Constitution. So get rid of it. And you'd be surprised by what would happen, because if you look back at some of the cases in the past where federal judges have invoked the necessary and proper, they say, well, this is necessary and proper. No. You don't need it. Get rid of that idea and then go back to the basic powers that are enumerated in the Constitution, and these are the only powers over which the federal government should have jurisdiction.
So we've got these three clauses, or these two clauses that can be easily amended to tighten their language, and one clause that probably should be deleted entirely. But here's the rub. How do you make these changes in the Constitution? Now, you and I both know there's two ways to amend the Constitution in Article 5. One is for Congress to take the initiative and to compose an amendment, pass it through a vote of two-thirds of both houses of Congress, and then send it out to the states for ratification. And if three-quarters of the states agree that that is a necessary amendment, then it becomes ratified and part of the Constitution. The second method in Article 5 bypasses Congress, and it was specifically put there by George Mason, who saw that what would happen if Congress becomes an obstacle and doesn't do what is right and proper on behalf of the American people, and doesn't want to initiate a needed amendment. And in that second process, then the states can apply to Congress for a convention for the purpose of discussing and passing a proposed amendment to the Constitution, or several. And then when those pass through the convention, then they are sent out by Congress to the states for ratification. And once again, if three-quarters of the states will ratify those amendments, they become part of the Constitution. So this is the twofold method, one involving Congress and one bypassing Congress if Congress refuses or is hesitant to act in this regard. And these are pretty controversial today, particularly the second one, because anytime you talk about amending the Constitution, people get really edgy because everyone has their pet part of the Constitution that they don't want messed with. And there's this feeling that if you start proposing changes to the Constitution, that one of their pet clauses will end up getting affected. Now, what is your view of this whole idea of a constitutional convention, the second method, as a means of bypassing Congress if Congress doesn't take action to pass needed amendments to the Constitution?
Well, I think that George Mason had it essentially right. There's a bias to the congressional route, and the bias is this. If you look at Congress as a whole, these are people who are attracted to power. I mean, that's basic human nature. There are some exceptions, some notable exceptions in there. There are some people who will simply look at proposed legislation and say, I'm not going to go along with this unless it is consistent with the Constitution. But how many senators and representatives do we know who think that way? So basically, anything that does not threaten Congress's powers, has a chance with the congressional route. Anything that does threaten it, however, and we're talking about some things that would curtail the Congress's powers legitimately, then they're not likely to go along with it. So I think George Mason's approach of the Convention of the States is the only logical way to deal with certain kinds of amendments, certainly the kinds of amendments that I'm talking about that constrain the power of the federal government.
So under that methodology, then, two-thirds of the states have to apply to Congress. Now, over the years, I think the number I've heard is there have been something like 800 different applications to Congress for a constitutional convention, and yet Congress has never called one. Why do you suppose that has been?
Well, number one, they don't want to call a convention of the states for the very reasons that I've mentioned. And the states themselves have to take the initial action before they could recognize that action and actually call the convention. They don't really have any decision-making capability in that case. If the states say it must be done, if they have the appropriate 34 states, then it must be done.
Right. But I think the one of the reasons that Congress has not called a convention is because these 500 or 800 applications, whatever the right number is, have been all across the board in terms of their focus. Some have asked for a convention for a balanced budget amendment. Some have asked for a convention to pass a term limits amendment. Some have asked Congress for a convention to pass X, Y, or Z amendments. And so because there have not been 34 applications specifically asking Congress for exactly the same thing, some people feel that Congress has used that rationale to avoid calling for a convention. And so if 34 applications came into Congress asking for exactly the same sort of convention, and I'm being a little disingenuous here because I know that that is exactly the strategy of what's called the Convention of the States Project. 34 states apply to Congress for a convention using exactly the same terminology. How can Congress then ignore that and not, as required by the Constitution's Article 5, call the convention?
Well, the uniformity of language, I think, is important. However, I think there is a problem with the way some people have used the Convention of States idea. They've used it as a mechanism for their pet project. For example, the balanced budget amendment, which on the surface sounds just like a super idea. You know, finally we're going to constrain the federal government. Well, I've seen some of the wordings, and they're frightening. I would never go along with some of these balanced budget schemes, which have so many loopholes in them that they're a lawyer's dream and an ordinary citizen's nightmare. And they wouldn't really constrain the federal government at all, and in fact would even encourage them to act in ways that the ordinary citizen might not want. So I think that the language that must be used cannot be tied to specific amendments. I think that it has to be more general than that. And if it is general, then it is a matter of pure numbers. If 34 states sign on to the language, they use uniform language, that convention will be called. And then the fear that some people have, which I think is unfounded, is we'll have a runaway convention. Well, first of all, you have to realize that 38 states must ratify in order to change any part of the Constitution. And the possibility of getting 38 states to run away from the current Constitution is slim to none. So, and incidentally, one could say realistically that neither a progressive nor a conservative point of view is likely to be dominant in such a convention of the states. So why do it anyway? And the answer is you do it for educational purposes, because this is the way that we can get our citizens involved in the Constitution. You know, it's their protection. Government has an inherent, or I should say the governing class rather than the abstraction called government. The governing classes have this inherent tendency towards tyrannical action towards the people. And a constitution protects the people. So the idea is, unless they understand it as ordinary citizens, and as I mentioned earlier, it is within the grasp of an ordinary citizen to go through those 26 pages and ultimately to understand them. Unless that education occurs, citizens in the United States are not in a position to protect themselves against government.
Well, I agree entirely, and that's why I'm teaching the Constitution. I'm sure that's your motivation as well. But we have 325 million people to educate and very little time to do it. That's why we need programs like the Institute on the Constitution, and we need average citizens to step up and say, I will host a course in my living room, and I'll gather my neighbors around, and we will study this document because it is absolutely necessary. The first three words tell it all. We the people. It is our individual document now that the states have, the original 13 states composed that convention and established that document, but they turned it over to we the people to ratify, and so now it's ours, and we need to do something. We need to make sure that we keep it. As Franklin said coming out of the convention, we've given you a republic, madam, if you can keep it. Well, the keeping is where the rubber meets the road, and people forget that there's an individual responsibility in that keeping. The keeping of our republic as a republic involves an individual responsibility and action, and that action has to be informed. It has to be educated. It has to know what the issues are and what the proper way to proceed is. So education is the key here, and I am so glad that you're involved in the Osher Lifelong Institute program with your Constitution course. I am really looking for some opportunity to come up there at a time when that course starts, and maybe it'll be next spring. But I'd love to take your course, and I'd love to see that class full of people anxious to learn about their Constitution. What is the average size of your class, and how many could you accommodate?
Well, I've had classes as small as a half a dozen people up to about 25 or 30. So it's all over the lot, and I have to acknowledge that a couple of years ago there was greater interest. I think people are getting a little bit numbed by what's happening in Washington right now. But basically, you know, the people are out there. There's no question about it. You need a way to reach them. And I think external events will do it. I mean, a financial tragedy in the United States might wake a lot of people up, and other events. If I could make a point about education, there is a very, very easy route into learning the Constitution. I would recommend going online and taking the Hillsdale College Constitution course. It is excellent. It's a series of, I think, about 10 courses altogether. And there is one in particular, the seventh, which is it's about the progressive assault on the Declaration of Independence, which occurred in the latter half of the 19th century. And, you know, we can understand where progressivism came from and the source, which is frightening, by the way. It's Hegel and the Prussian education system. That's a great start.
I'm so glad you mentioned Hillsdale. I mentioned that in all of my courses as well. That's a great place to start. And as you said, no expense involved. Just go online and take these courses at your own time. Well, we're almost out of time, and I am so thankful I've had a chance to have this conversation with Phil Duffy, an instructor at the Osher Lifelong Institute, and learn a little bit more about our Constitution. And we will see you next week at the same time, study more about our Constitution. I hope you'll join us. We the People, the Constitution Matters. I'm your host, Gary Porter. We'll see you next week.
Hi, I'm Hans Tenbaum with Valley Forge PC Repair. I offer affordable and expert computer repair services. Deal with a locally owned business who cares more about their clients' needs. The services provided include virus removal, repair, cleanups, tune-ups, tutoring, consulting, and other computer services. Most services can be done at a flat rate. Senior citizens mentioned WFIL receive a 10% discount. Call me at 610-462-3210 for more information.
ShopRite of Hatfield is American-owned, locally operated grocer. We support veterans and seniors by giving 5% discounts. Just bring in your ID. Download the ShopRite mobile app to enjoy weekly savings, coupons, recipes, and so much more. ShopRite of Hatfield, 170 40-foot Road, open 7 days a week, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m.
ShopRite, we're all about food, savings, and you.